West Legal Aid Center would like to welcome you to the audio program, Whistleblowing in the Corporate World Series, Part 2, A Securities Law Primer. Thank you for joining our presenter, Jordan A. Thomas, a partner at Labaton Susharo. Jordan shares its whistleblower representation practice. Labaton Susharo is one of the country's premier private securities litigation firms and the first law firm in the country to establish a practice exclusively focused on protecting and advocating for SEC whistleblowers. Prior to joining Labaton, Jordan spent more than 15 years in federal law enforcement as both a trial attorney at the Department of Justice and an assistant director in the Enforcement Division of the Securities and Exchange Commission. While at the agency, Jordan played a leadership role in the development of the SEC Whistleblower Program. Currently, he is also the editor of SECWhistleblowerAdvocate.com, a website dedicated to helping responsible organizations establish a culture of integrity and courageous whistleblowers to report possible securities violations without personal or professional regrets. Please submit questions by clicking the Submit Questions button located directly under your viewer window. The program materials are located to the right of your viewer window. Thank you for joining us, and I will now turn things over to our speaker.
Thank you. Good morning, and thank you for participating in today's second installment of our webinar series, Whistleblowing in the Corporate World. In our first program, the advent of the SEC Whistleblower Program, we addressed the origin and the basic mechanics of the SEC Whistleblower Program. If you missed this program or any other part in the series, you can always view it on demand at the West Legal Aid Center. Now, to better understand the scope and reach of this important investor protection program, my presentation today will provide a general introduction and overview of the laws governing the securities industry. I'll give particular focus to the laws governing the enforcement of the securities laws because the SEC Whistleblower Program offers the ability to report anonymously and significant employment protections and monetary awards to individuals that report violations of the federal securities laws. Whether you are a practitioner in another area of law, a business person in a regulated industry, or a potential whistleblower tuning in for a quick, down and dirty legal primer, in today's increasingly global marketplace, this is an important, complex, and rapidly changing area of the law. As an SEC whistleblower advocate, I have found that sophisticated potential whistleblowers attempt to determine whether a securities violation has occurred, assess the significance of any violation, and evaluate the probability of a successful SEC enforcement action before internally or externally reporting a possible securities violation. This program and other resources on SECWhistleblowerAdvocate.com are designed to help whistleblowers and other interested parties to answer these sometimes challenging questions. Presentation to get you up to speed, I will be answering 10 common questions about the federal securities laws and providing 5 insider tips for potential SEC whistleblowers. These questions are, first, what constitutes a security? Second, what laws govern the securities industry? Third, what is the international reach of the U.S. securities laws? Types of securities law violations. Fifth, what is the statute of limitations for SEC enforcement action? Sixth, is the possible securities violation legal? Seventh, is there evidence of intentional misconduct? I'm hearing typing in the background. What types of actions can be brought to enforce the securities laws is number 8. Number 9, if an SEC enforcement action is successful, what remedies are available? And finally, 10, where can potential whistleblowers and other interested parties learn more about the securities laws and the SEC enforcement process? So let's begin. Next slide. What constitutes a security? Next slide. The SEC Whistleblower Program is limited to whistleblowers who report a possible violation of the federal securities laws that has occurred, is ongoing, or is about to occur. Accordingly, a key issue when considering whether a particular financial instrument or transaction is covered by the securities laws is the meaning of the word security. For non-lawyers, beyond traditional stocks and bonds, I think you will find that the definition of securities is quite broad. Under Section 2A1 of the Securities Act of 1933, a security is defined to include, among other things, any note, stock, treasury stock, securities future, securities-based swap, bond, debenture, evidence of indebtedness. A certificate of interest or participation in any profit-sharing agreement, collateral trust certificate, pre-organization certificate or subscription, transferable share, investment contract, voting trust certificate, certificate of deposit for a security, a fractional undivided interest in oil, gas, or other mineral rights, and lastly, any put, call, straddle, option, or privilege on any security, certificate of deposit, or group of index securities, or any put, call, straddle, option, or privilege entered into on a national securities exchange relating to a foreign currency, or in general, any interest or instrument commonly known as a security. Similar definitions of security can be found in other security statutes, including Section 3A10 of the Securities and Exchange Act of 1934. Next slide. Most of the instruments listed in the Securities Act definition of security are straightforward, things like stocks and bonds. However, in some cases, it's not so clear, particularly when determining what constitutes an investment contract. In the SEC v. Howey case, the U.S. Supreme Court held that an investment contract is a security if it has four basic elements: an investment of money, a common enterprise, expectation of a profit, and solely from the efforts of others. Next slide. What laws govern the securities industry? This is the second question. Next slide. Securities regulations come from many different sources. The first is state securities laws, otherwise known as blue sky laws. Originally, securities regulation in the United States was only a matter of state law. In fact, Congress didn't pass the first federal securities law until more than 20 years after the first state blue sky law was passed. Today, however, state securities laws have taken a back seat to federal laws, and a vast majority of securities regulation in the United States is now primarily a matter of federal law. That being said, in the enforcement context, misconduct often constitutes both a violation of state and federal law. When examining the federal securities laws, often the best starting point will be the governing statute. There are seven key federal securities statutes, which will be discussed in the next slides. Federal securities laws can also be found in rules and regulations. Various statutes empower the Securities and Exchange Commission to enact rules and regulations to interpret and implement federal law. Another source of federal securities law are administrative releases, which essentially represent the Commission's views on legal questions and decisions of the Commission in administrative proceedings brought by the SEC to enforce the federal securities laws. Of course, as with most statutes, some provisions of the federal securities laws are sometimes unclear and open to interpretation. This void is filled by decisions of federal courts, often referred to as common law, that interpret these statutes in the context of a lawsuit. These cases have developed an important part of securities regulation, including establishing private remedies where none explicitly existed in the statutes. Finally, self-regulatory organizations play an important role in regulating and overseeing securities markets and professionals. The Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, or FINRA, is the largest independent self-regulatory organization. FINRA's mission is to protect American investors by making sure the securities industry operates fairly and honestly. To that end, it oversees all brokerage firms and securities exchanges that do business with the public. Next slide. Since federal statutes are the primary source of laws governing the securities industry, let's look at the key statutes. The first is the Securities Act of 1933, commonly referred to as the Securities Act. The next is the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, commonly referred to as the Exchange Act. The next is the Trust Indenture Act of 1939. Following that is the Investment Company Act of 1940 and the Investment Advisors Act of 1940. Several years later, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002. And finally, the Dodd-Frank Wall Street and Consumer Protection Act of 2010. Next slide. The Securities Act of 1933 was the first major piece of legislation enacted by Congress to address the issues that led to the stock market crash of 1929. Its purpose is to ensure that investors received adequate financial and other important information about securities being offered to the public, and to ensure that the information that was provided, or is provided rather, is accurate and reliable. To help meet these objectives, the Securities Act sets forth many requirements on the issuer of securities, most important of which are registration requirements, a prospectus requirement, and the prohibition of false and misleading statements. Let's start with the registration requirement. The Securities Act requires that all securities offered for sale in the U.S. must either be registered with the SEC or qualify for an exemption from registration. Registration requires the filing of a registration statement with the SEC each time a company issues securities, so that all securities sold will be associated with a particular registration statement. The registration statement must contain, in general, the following information: a description of the company and its business, a description of the security to be offered for sale, information about the management of the company, and the company's financial statements certified by independent public accountants. The Securities Act prohibits any offers to buy or sell the securities being issued prior to filing of the registration statement. Once the registration statement is filed, but before it is approved by the SEC and thus effective, securities can be offered for sale but cannot actually be sold. Let's now talk about the prospectus requirement. The Securities Act requires that a company offering a securities for sale to the public must also submit to the SEC and provide to each potential purchaser of the securities a prospectus that contains much of the same information as a registration statement, and also such details as the exact number of shares being offered for sale and the offering price of those shares. The purpose here is to provide a potential investor with full disclosure. That is, giving the investor enough information about a company and the stock being offered for sale so that the investor is able to make an informed investing decision. And the last provision that's important in the Securities Act is that it creates a cause of action for any purchaser of securities pursuant to a registration statement or prospectus that contains false and misleading statements. Key sections to look at in here are Sections 11, 12, and 17A. Next slide. While the Securities Act largely regulates the initial offering of securities by issuers, the Exchange Act primarily regulates the activities of a publicly traded companies and transactions of securities in the secondary market. The secondary market refers to transactions in a security by and among investors after the security has already been publicly issued, such as trades that retail investors execute through a broker. Among other things, the Exchange Act established the SEC, and empowered the Commission with broad authority over all aspects of the security industry. This includes the power to investigate and prosecute violations of the federal securities laws, as well as the power to regulate and oversee brokerage firms, transfer agents, clearing agencies, and stock exchanges. Next is the reporting requirement. A critical purpose of the Exchange Act is to regulate the activities of companies that have securities sold on a public exchange. Section 12 of the Exchange Act thus requires any issuer having a class of securities traded on a national securities exchange or with over 500 shareholders and over $10 million in assets to register those securities with the SEC. This registration is different from the registration under the Securities Act, which requires the registration of securities being sold in a public offering. Once these securities are issued, and if publicly traded on a national exchange, the securities would have to be registered under Section 12 of the Exchange Act. Once registered, a company is required to file various reports with the SEC, such as quarterly and annual reports, and reports when significant events occur. Another unique aspect of the Exchange Act is proxy solicitations. The Exchange Act authorized the SEC to promulgate rules for the solicitation of proxies by public companies from their shareholders. Under this authority, the Commission has established rules regarding the disclosure of information to shareholders for purposes of shareholder votes on the election of directors and the approval of other corporate actions, such as mergers. This information contained in proxy materials must be filed with the Commission in advance of any solicitation of shareholder votes to ensure compliance with the disclosure rules. Proxy solicitations, whether by management or shareholders groups, must disclose all material facts concerning the issues on which shareholders are asked to vote. Change of control notice. The Exchange Act also requires the disclosure of material information by anyone seeking to acquire more than 5% of a company's securities by direct purchase or tender offer. Such an offer is often extended in an effort to gain control of the company. As with the proxy rules, this allows shareholders to make an informed decision on whether to sell their shares pursuant to the offer. Another component of the Exchange Act that's important is the broker-dealer regulation. Under Section 15A of the Exchange Act, any person who wants to engage in business as a broker or dealer must register with the SEC. And then the SEC has the authority to revoke or suspend a broker or dealer's registration if the broker or dealer is found to have violated any of the securities laws. In general, under these provisions, broker dealers are required to deal fairly with their customers, including the obligation to make recommendations that are consistent with their customers' interests. Broker dealers are required under certain circumstances to disclose material conflicts of interest to their customers, in some cases, at the time of the completion of the transaction. The Trust Indenture Act generally prohibits debt securities. This is the next slide. The Trust Indenture Act generally prohibits debt securities, such as bonds, debentures, and notes, from being offered for sale to the public without a formal written agreement, known as a trust indenture. This restriction only applies to debt issues that are valued over $5 million. In addition, the Trust Indenture Act requires that a trustee be appointed to all bond issuers, so that should the issuer become insolvent, the trustee may seize the bond issuer's assets and sell them in order to recoup the bondholder's investments. Next slide. The Investment Company Act regulates investment funds, such as mutual funds, that are engaged primarily in the business of investing, reinvesting, or trading in securities, or are engaged in that business and more than 40% of their assets consist of investment securities. Under the Act, these companies must file a notice of registration and annual reports with the SEC. The Act places certain limitations on the trading activities of investment companies, such as prohibiting purchases on margin, selling short, and participating in joint trading accounts. The Investment Company Act does not permit the SEC to directly supervise the investment decisions or activities of these companies or judge the merits of their investments. Rather, the focus is on disclosure of material information to investors. The next significant statute and the next slide is the Investment Advisors Act. The Investment Advisors Act, with certain exceptions, requires the firms or individuals compensated for advising others about securities investments must register with the SEC and conform to regulations designed to protect investors. After a 1996 amendment, only advisors who have at least $25 million of assets under management or who advise a registered investment company, such as a mutual fund, must register with the commission. The Act imposes liability on investment advisors who engage in fraudulent or deceptive conduct in connection with their services. Unlike other anti-fraud provisions, Rule 206 is not limited to fraud and deceit in connection with the purchase or sale of a security. Moreover, the section applies to all investment advisors, whether they are required to register with the SEC or not. Section 206(3) also prohibits an investment advisor from engaging in securities transactions for its own account with a client absent the client's prior consent. It also prohibits an advisor from arranging, acting as a broker, a transaction between different advisory clients or between a brokerage customer and an advisory client. The SEC may bring an enforcement action under Section 206 even if there is no actual injury to a client. Next slide. The Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002 mandated a number of reforms to enhance financial disclosures made by public companies and to combat financial fraud. A few of the more prominent of these reforms was the creation of the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board to oversee the activities of independent auditors. The requirement that all audited financial statements be certified as accurate by a corporation's senior management, and the requirement that companies establish internal control and reporting systems to uncover fraud in financial reporting. Next slide. On July 21, 2010, Congress enacted the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, one of the most significant financial reform efforts since the Great Depression. Among other things, Dodd-Frank created the Financial Stability Oversight Council to identify risks to the United States' financial stability that may arise from the activities of large, interconnected financial companies, promote market discipline, and eliminate expectations of government bailouts, and respond to emerging threats to countries' financial stability. It also requires that hedge funds managing over $100 million in assets as investment advisors register with the SEC. Added to, along with this, it established the SEC whistleblower program for individuals who provide information about possible securities violations, which offers anonymous reporting, employment protections, and monetary awards. The implementing rules for the program became effective on August 12, 2011. Next slide. What is the international reach of the U.S. securities laws? Next slide. The economy is global, and so is securities fraud. The SEC whistleblower program recognizes that the financial markets are boundless. Accordingly, possible securities violations that occur anywhere in the world are eligible for the program. Potential international violators can be individuals or organizations, both public and private. Similarly, a whistleblower can be anyone regardless of citizenship. According to the 2011 annual report of the SEC Whistleblower Program, which reported on program activity for the 7-week period between the effective date of the program's implementing rules and the close of the agency's fiscal year, nearly 10% of the tips came from foreign jurisdictions, including the UK, Australia, China, Canada, Italy, Norway, Serbia, Spain, the Netherlands, Turkey, and Uruguay. This is particularly significant given the fact that the program has not been widely advertised or reported on abroad. So, if you're a senior officer at an international bank, hedge fund, or investment advisor, does the long arm of the U.S. financial regulators and law enforcement authorities reach you and your organization? Probably. As you may know, Dodd-Frank obliterated many of the exemptions for investment advisors and non-U.S. entities to avoid SEC regulation. While each case is different, here are a few basic ways to determine whether your organization may be subject to U.S. jurisdiction. If you have U.S. clients, U.S. investors, U.S. investments, U.S. operations, or U.S. employees, it may be subject to SEC jurisdiction. Simplifying a complex issue even further, if entities use the U.S. mail in connection with regular business activities, they may want to consult with counsel to understand their potential legal exposure to U.S. laws. Finally, Dodd-Frank expressly permits the SEC and other law enforcement authorities to share information provided by whistleblowers with foreign regulatory and law enforcement authorities. To this end, the close working relationship between the SEC and international authorities will become even closer, and these authorities will benefit from greater access to actionable intelligence that will help them to protect the investors within their countries. Next slide. In numerous circumstances, the U.S. securities laws will apply to transactions that have some connection to foreign countries or foreign investors. For example, public offerings to U.S. investors by foreign issuers are subject to the registration requirements of the Securities Act. Foreign purchasers of securities issued in the U.S. have the same investor protection rights as U.S. securities purchasers. U.S. companies that issue classes of securities solely to foreign investors do not need to register under the Securities Act here in the U.S. if those securities are restricted from transactions with U.S. investors in the aftermarket. Next slide. Application of Section 10B and Rule 10B-5 thereunder internationally. Recently, in Morrison v. National Australia Bank, the U.S. Supreme Court held generally that the primary anti-fraud provisions of the securities laws, Section 10B and Rule 10B-5 of the Exchange Act, apply only to transactions and securities listed on U.S. exchanges and domestic transactions in non-listed securities. Next slide. What are the most common types of securities law violations? Next slide. Now that we can identify securities, the laws that govern the securities industry, and the international reach of these laws, let's look at common types of securities violations. As a preliminary matter, when evaluating a case, it is important to determine whether the potential defendant is a primary or secondary violator. A primary violation occurs when all the requirements of a federal securities law violation have been met by the defendant. The most common primary violations charged by the SEC are Sections 10B of the Exchange Act and Section 17A of the Securities Act. A secondary violation occurs when all the requirements of a federal securities law violation have not been met by the defendant, but a theory of secondary liability applies. The most common such violations are control person and aiding and abetting liability. In circumstances where secondary liability is appropriate, the person will be held liable in the same way as the primary violators in the case are. So let's walk through each of these common statutory violations. Section 10B and Rule 10B-5. I'm sorry, next slide. Section 10B and Rule 10B-5 have been developed into the most important weapon for the SEC and private investors in combating misconduct in connection with securities transactions. These are catch-all provisions designed to prevent any abusive practice not prohibited by a specific section of the securities laws. Section 10B prohibits the use or employ of any manipulative or deceptive device or contrivance in connection with the purchase or sale of a security. Rule 10b-5 generally makes it unlawful to engage in any fraudulent or deceptive conduct or make any untrue statement of a material fact or to omit to state a material fact in connection with the purchase or sale of any security. To be held liable under Section 10b and Rule 10b-5, and any person must have acted with scienter. That is the deliberate intent to deceive, or at the very least, extreme recklessness. We'll discuss the required intent later on in this program. One unique aspect of 10b is that courts have interpreted it to permit private rights of action. Although not provided for in the statute or the rule, courts have long held that private investors may bring an action for damages under Section 10b and Rule 10b-5. In a private action, plaintiffs have the burden of establishing three additional elements to state a valid claim. First, the plaintiff must establish that he or she relied on the fraudulent statement or conduct when deciding whether to buy or sell the security. In other words, the fraudulent statement or conduct must have played a role in the investment decision. Because fraudulent statements and omissions are often made to the public and not to an individual investor, courts developed a theory of reliance called fraud on the market. When a security is traded on a large, efficient securities exchange, fraud on the market presumes that the price of a security reflects all publicly available information about that security. Thus, any person who buys or sells that security is presumed to have relied on that information. Thus, any person can also show that he or she actually does not have to show, rather, that he or she actually read or heard the misstatement or omission. It is assumed, based on the fraud on the markets theory. Second, the private plaintiff must also establish that the material misstatement or omission caused and damages, that is, must be a causal connection between the material misstatement or omission and the loss suffered. Finally, the private plaintiff must have suffered a loss as a result of the material misstatement or omission. In general, this would be the difference between the price paid for the security, which was inflated because of the fraud, and the price at which the security was sold after the fraud was revealed. Next slide. Section 17A of the Securities Act. Section 17A of the Securities Act and Section 10B of the Exchange Act are very similar. Both address the same three types of misconduct, where there's been a device, scheme, or artifice to defraud, where there's been material misrepresentations or omissions, or there's been a fraudulent transaction or course of business. In fact, in most cases, the SEC will charge both violations, and evidence of misconduct will satisfy both sections. However, Section 10B is slightly broader because it applies to the purchase or sale of any security compared to the offer or sale of any security for Section 17A. The one benefit associated with 17A is that subsections 2 and 3 permit a showing of negligence rather than a higher standard of knowledge or reckless conduct. Next slide. Section 20A of the Exchange Act, or control person liability, is a form of secondary liability. To establish a control person violation, the SEC must establish a primary violation of the Exchange Act. Defendants had direct or indirect control over the person engaged in the primary violation. Now, there is an affirmative defense to control person liability. If a defendant will not be found liable if she or he acted in good faith and did not directly or indirectly induce the act or acts constituting the violation or cause of action. Next slide. Section 20E of the Exchange Act, aiding and abetting liability. to establish aiding and abetting liability, the SEC must establish a primary violation of the Exchange Act, that the defendant was knowing or reckless, and substantial assistance was provided by the defendant to the person engaged in the primary violation. To determine whether substantial assistance has been provided, there are several factors that courts often rely on, such as the nature of the act, the amount of assistance, presence or absence of the defendant at the time of misconduct, relation to the primary violator, and the duration of the assistance provided. Next slide. Common securities violations. This slide lists the most common types of securities violations investigated and prosecuted by the SEC, from the most common to the less common, as reported by the SEC Whistleblower Office. The seven types of violations are market manipulation, offering fraud, financial fraud, insider trading, trading and pricing, Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, and municipal securities fraud. Let's look at each. Market manipulation. Market manipulation is the interference with the free and fair operation of the market by engaging in transactions and other practices that create or maintain an artificial price for security. Examples of market manipulation include churning, which is placing both buy and sell orders for the same security at about the same price in order to create the appearance of increased trading activity, thereby increasing its price. Pooling, an agreement among a group of people delegating authority to a single manager to trade in a specific stock for a specific period of time and then to share in the resulting profits or losses. Another form of market manipulation is the pump and dump scheme, which involves spreading false information to increase the price of a security and then selling shares at the increased price. Next slide. Offering fraud. Offering fraud involves making material misrepresentations and omissions to potential investors in connection with an offering of securities. Examples include unregistered offerings. This is where securities being sold are not registered with the SEC as required under the Securities Act. A Ponzi scheme, this is where investors are paid returns from their own money or from the money invested by subsequent investors rather than from any actual profits earned. And the last type of offering fraud discussed here is affinity fraud, which is a type of fraud that targets members of an identifiable group, such as a religious or ethnic community, in order to induce those members to invest in a fraudulent investment opportunity. Next slide. Financial fraud. Financial fraud occurs when a public company files materially false or misleading financial statements with the SEC. Examples include misleading disclosures, misclassifications of numbers, improper recording of transactions, overstatements, and understatements. The most common type of violation that applies when there is a restatement is revenue recognition. Next slide. Insider trading. Insider trading is the buying or selling of a corporate security while in possession of material information about that corporation that is not known to the public. There are two theories of insider trading. There's the classical theory, which involves corporate insiders who have access to material non-public information based on their positions inside a corporation. The second theory is the misappropriation theory, which involves third parties who acquire material non-public information about a corporation based on some relationship of trust with the source of the information. Next slide. Trading and pricing. Trading and pricing violations involve any number of trading techniques that are illegal under the securities laws. Examples include market timing or late trading. This occurs when a mutual fund permits select customers to purchase shares in the fund after trading has closed for the day. Wash trades. This is a practice that involves the buying and selling of the same security for the purpose of generating activity and increasing the price. Marking the close. This is a practice of buying or selling security near the close of the day's trading in order to affect the closing price. Finally, front running. Buying or selling security while knowing that another investor is about to trade or an analyst will make a recommendation that will influence the price of the security. Next slide. Foreign Corrupt Practice Act violations. The FCPA prohibits the offer, payment, or promise to pay, money, or anything of value, i.e. a bribe, to any foreign official in an effort to win or retain business from that foreign official's government. There are two affirmative defenses to Foreign Corrupt Practice Act violations. The first is the payments are legal under the written laws of the country in which the payments are made, or the payment is a reasonable expenditure directly related to conducting of business with a foreign government. Next slide. Municipal securities fraud. Municipal securities fraud occurs when materially false or misleading statements are made to investors in connection with the purchase or sale of debt securities issued by state and local governments in the United States. Next slide. What is the statute of limitations for bringing an SEC enforcement action? Next slide. The governing statute is 28 U.S.C. section 2462. This is a catch-all statute of limitations for actions brought by the federal agencies in federal court. Under this statute, the SEC has 5 years to bring an enforcement action seeking civil penalties from the date that the claim first accrued. That being said, please note this statute only bars civil penalties. All other types of remedies remain available. Remember, though, the older the case, the less likely the SEC is likely to investigate it due to limited resources. So it's in your interest to report misconduct earlier rather than later. Let's talk about the tolling of the statute. There are ways in which to stop the clock, if you will. The two theories that are most common are the discovery rule, which is a common law rule that applies only to fraud claims and holds that the statute of limitations for a fraud claim does not accrue until the fraud is discovered or could have been discovered with reasonable diligence. In the Second Circuit, there is an important case entitled Gabelli that is worth looking at. If this is something that you're interested in and you're appearing in the Second Circuit. Fraudulent concealment or equitable tolling. This is another theory that temporarily suspends the statute of limitations clock, even though a claim has already accrued, if the defendant took affirmative steps to conceal the wrongful conduct. SEC or private plaintiffs must plead facts establishing that the defendant took affirmative steps to conceal the wrongdoing. Next slide. Is the possible securities violation legally material? To establish a claim for securities fraud, it is not enough that a defendant made a false statement or omitted to state a fact that would made the statement not misleading. Rather, the securities laws only impose liability for misstatements or omissions that are material. There's a large body of law regarding this concept of materiality, but in general, information is material when a reasonable investor would have considered the information misstated or omitted important when making their investment decision. The two leading Supreme Court cases on materiality are TSC Industries versus Northway and Basic versus Levinson. In TSC Industries, the Supreme Court, for the first time, established a uniform definition for the meaning of materiality. The case involved a shareholder vote on a proposed merger and whether the shareholders were provided enough information prior to the vote. The shareholders claimed that the proxy solicitation was false and misleading because it failed to provide certain material information. After examining different definitions previously used by lower courts, the Supreme Court created the following standard. Information is material if there is a substantial likelihood that a reasonable shareholder would consider it important in deciding how to vote. In Basic v. Levinson, the Supreme Court expressly adopted the standard articulated in TSC Industries for claims brought under Section 10b and Rule 10b-5. Thus, the Court held that to fulfill the materiality requirement of a securities fraud claim, there must be a substantial likelihood that the disclosure of the omitted fact would have been viewed by the reasonable investor as having significantly altered the total mix of information made available. Next slide. Theories of materiality. Courts often measure the materiality of information quantitatively or qualitatively. The quantitative theory quantifies the amount misstated or omitted as a percentage of the reported earnings or losses. Some courts have stated there's a rule of thumb that more than 5% deviation from the actual reported financials measure is material. Generally, it's not appropriate to rely only on quantitative measures alone. However, if you have a case where you have a deviation of more than 5%, that's a very good sign that it will be deemed material. Now, whether the misstatement is the, whether the material, whether it's qualitatively material, the court will look at all the relevant circumstances surrounding the quantitative measure of misstatement or omission. The SEC Staff Accounting Bulletin, number 99, provides a non-exhaustive list of qualitative factors that could affect the materiality of information. These factors could turn a quantitatively small misstatement or omission into a material misstatement or omission. Here are some examples of a list of qualitative factors that could affect the materiality of information. If it arises from an item capable of precise measurement or whether it arises from an estimate, and if so, the degree of imprecision inherent in that estimate. If the information masks a change in earnings or other trends, if the information hides a failure to meet analyst consensus expectations for the enterprise, if the misstatement changes a loss into income or vice versa, if the misstatement or omission concerns a segment or other portion of the registrant's business that has been identified as playing a significant role in the registrant's operations or profitability, if the misstatement affects the registrant's compliance with regulatory requirements, if the misstatement or omission affects the registrant's compliance with loan covenants or other contractual requirements, if the misstatement or omission has the effect of increasing management's compensation, and lastly, if the omission or misstatement involves concealment of an unlawful transaction. A good example of this might be bribery. Next slide. Is there evidence of intentional misconduct? Next slide. Scienter is a mental state embracing intent to deceive, manipulate, or defraud. This is the definition given to us by the Supreme Court in Ernst and Ernst versus Hochfelder. Next slide. Let's talk about types of intentional misconduct. A showing of intentional or reckless conduct is required to establish fraud in connection with violations of Section 17A1 of the Securities Act and 10B of the Exchange Act. Scienter can be established with evidence of intentional or knowing conduct, which an example of this would be knowingly making a false statement, or recklessness, which is conduct which is highly unreasonable and which represents an extreme departure from the standards of ordinary care. A showing of negligence is sufficient to establish fraud in connection with violations of Section 17A2 and 3 of the Securities Act. Negligence is a failure to use such care as a reasonable, prudent, and careful person would use under similar circumstances. Although several cases are settled at the SEC using a negligence theory, most investigations are begun because there is a belief that there is misconduct that is greater than mere negligence. Next slide. A plaintiff bringing a securities fraud case must plead facts establishing a strong inference that the defendant acted with scienter. And in the same way, an SEC whistleblower should attempt to provide a submission that provides facts that establish a strong inference. Also, this can be accomplished by alleging facts that show the defendant had a motive or opportunity to commit fraud. Motive involves concrete benefits that could be realized by the misconduct. An opportunity is the means and likely prospect of achieving concrete benefits. Next, another way of establishing the strong inference is facts that constitute strong circumstantial evidence of conscious misbehavior or recklessness. This, in fact, is the most common basis for establishing scienter. It's rare that you have a smoking gun, like someone committing a crime on video. Next slide. What types of actions can be brought to enforce the securities laws? Next slide. There are a number of ways in which the securities laws are enforced. One is a criminal enforcement action by federal and state law enforcement authorities. This is typically occurs where the misconduct is significant or the evidence is particularly strong. Another way of work handling a case is a civil enforcement action by the SEC in district court. Another avenue is for the SEC to bring an administrative proceeding. And last are civil actions by private investors in federal and state courts around the country. Next slide. If an SEC enforcement action is successful, what remedies are available? There are a number of remedies that are available. First, injunctions. Injunctions prohibit the continuing and future violation of the federal securities laws. There's no requirement for irreparable injury or inadequate remedies at law to receive an injunction. Courts consider several factors, including past, current, or imminent violation of the securities laws and a reasonable likelihood of future violations. Another thing that courts consider as a remedy is disgorgement. Disgorgement is the repayment of money obtained as a result of wrongful conduct. It may also include losses avoided as a result of unlawful conduct. It includes prejudgment interest on the disgorged sum. Another remedy are penalties. Monetary penalties above and beyond are monetary penalties above and beyond any disgorgement ordered. The amounts depend on the nature of the violation and whether the defendant is an individual or an organization. Disgorgement and penalties and prejudgment interest are all part of the monetary sanctions that the SEC whistleblower program will consider when determining whether a whistleblower has satisfied the million-dollar minimum threshold, as well as determining a monetary award. So they're important things for potential whistleblowers to be familiar with. The last are bars. There are several types of bars. One is an officer and director bar, which is an individual prohibition that prohibits an individual from serving as an officer or director of a public company. Another bar is a penny stock bar. This is an individual prohibition that keeps individuals from being involved in enumerated ways with low-price speculative securities. Next slide. Where can potential whistleblowers and other interested parties learn more about the securities laws and the SEC enforcement process? If you'd like to learn more about the SEC whistleblower program or the securities laws in general, I encourage you to visit secwhistlebloweradvocate.com. This innovative website uses videos, searchable databases, eligibility calculators, comprehensive legal primers, thought leadership collections, and timely blog entries to help responsible organizations to establish a culture of integrity and courageous whistleblowers to report possible securities violations. Since our time's almost up, please, if you have any questions, this would be a great time for you to submit them. Well, since we don't have any questions, I thank you for participating in this program. And if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to contact me. The series will continue over the next several weeks. The next part will be accountants as whistleblowers, newly empowered to make ethical reporting choices. Part 4 is an insider's guide to the SEC enforcement process. Part 5, corporate lawyers as whistleblowers. And Part 6, whistleblowing and the corporate insider. Again, I thank you for participating and welcome any questions.